In the original Cinderella, you may remember, the ugly stepsisters actually sliced parts of their feet off to get them to fit into Cinderella's glass slippers. Yikes. Shades of foot and footwear abuse in our time, perhaps? Disney's source material, truth be told, seriously downplays all of the girl-eating wolves and girl-enslaving fathers and kings from the fairy tales, the witches brewing poison and bringing death to the adorable young faces you can find in them. Hey, Disney, Pixar, how about a turnip that turns into a princess, or maybe a toad? A whole bunch of new German fairy tale storylines have been found in a box in the city of Regensburg, Germany. More than 500 fairy tales that had been forgotten for over a century and a half. The tales had been compiled by Franz Xaver von Schönwandt, a 19th century Regensburg civil servant with a passion for folklore, and the stories can now be read in English for the first time in a book called The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. The characters in these stories are familiar, but the scenarios, like the original Grimm brothers, are all strangely dark. A prince with golden hair toils secretly as a gardener after his father tries to kill him. A toad turns into a beautiful bride. Great. A dragon is betrayed by his wife. Maria Tatar, a professor of Germanic languages and literatures at Harvard, is the book's translator. She's also chair of Harvard's folklore and mythology program.
Well, we have to remember they did emerge from oral storytelling cultures at a time when life was nasty, brutish, and short. But I think much more importantly, they are larger than life, and I would say twice as unnatural. They give us excess, exaggeration, melodrama. Remember, these were stories designed to keep people awake so that they could finish their chores. So they're full of the same things that we have in our entertainments today. They give us the great what-ifs. What if the worst thing imaginable happened? What would you do? How would you survive it?
Do you think the turnip princess story, the narrative there, got people talking?
Oh, for sure, because one of the things I love about the Schönwandt collection is that it's full of gaps and contradictions. So the story is told, and, you know, you're immediately asking yourself, wait a minute, what was that old woman doing there? Is she identical with the turnip princess? Why the rusty nail? So they are full of mysteries. They raise questions all the time. And, you know, think about that oral storytelling situation where the story is told, there's an audience present. So the teller is constantly being interrupted. There's commentary. And then I'm sure that there's a kind of reflex that takes place where somebody says, oh, I know another story sort of like that, or I can tell it better. So this art of improvisation that is triggered by a good story, I think, is very powerful and is still with us today.
What do we know about Schönwandt?
Well, we know that he was interested in what the brothers Grimm were doing, and he was deeply committed to his Bavarian homeland and wanted to sort of be the Bavarian answer to the brothers Grimm collect folklore. He was less connected to this idea of creating a literary heritage. That is, he really wanted to capture the voice of the people. And I love the fact that he found that his informants were reluctant to tell the story. So what did he do? He started bribing them. Now, of course, you might ask, doesn't that mean that the informants sort of gave him a distorted version of these stories? They gave him fairy tales that aimed to please an academic. There may be a certain amount of truth to that. But what Schönwandt found was once they became comfortable with him, they really got into the storytelling mode. So I think they didn't edit themselves or censor themselves all that much.
As a folklorist, can you tell the difference between a tale which might have been elaborated upon to get maybe more of a payment and one that might have been absolutely authentic that could have survived for, you know, many, many hundreds of years passed down generation to generation?
Oh, that's really tough. It is a challenge to try to separate those things out. I've often found that the inclusion of a moral is a tip-off to the fact that there is a certain amount of editing going on and that there's an effort, you know, to clean up the story, to move it from the fireside, where adults were telling these racy, bawdy stories, into the nursery, where you were trying to discipline the child to be obedient, because if they were not, something terrible could happen to them. I think of the Grimm's Frog Prince and the moment when the father says to his daughter, if you made a promise, you must keep it. Now, the promise is that she lets the frog sleep with her in her bed. And that frog, of course, as we know, turns into a prince. But, you know, that odd lesson, which doesn't really square with what's going on in the story. So when I see this disconnect between the story and the lesson that is embedded in it, I know that there's something strange going on in terms of editing.
With Schoenvatt's work, there's also the narrative of taking the stories and using them for political means. And this was done in the 1930s. There are certainly lots of examples of stories being used for nationalist aims of one kind or another. How did that work here in the Schoenvatt stories?
Schoenvatt's collection, of course, wasn't in the school curriculum the way that the Brothers Grimm were. And, of course, what raised a red flag in the post-war era, post-World War II, were stories like not only Hansel and Gretel, where the witch is famously shoved into an oven, but there are a couple of virulently anti-Semitic tales in the Grimm's collection. The Jew in the Thorn Bush is one of them. And the stories in the post-war period were banned from schools. What is interesting to me is you don't find a trace of anti-Semitism in Schoenvatt.
You know, when I read the Turnip Princess, I can't help but kind of distort it through my own lens because it does feel like something that's improvised, almost like a jazz solo. Somebody, like, tell me a story now. And with my own kids, you know, oh, well, there was this turnip, like the one right here, and it turns into a giant bowl over here. And do you see them holding together in some way or following a rhythm that we maybe don't understand these days?
I love the blues metaphor or analogy because it is a little bit, there's a quality of improvisation and then splicing things together and taking bits and pieces from what surrounds you, from everyday reality, but then adding magic and the extraordinary. I love the title Turnip Princess because it melds the ordinary with the extraordinary, a princess. And that is part of the art of storytelling. My hope is actually that somebody will take this collection, and actually this has already happened on the internet, that they've refashioned the stories, made them smoother, filled in those gaps, turned them into literary fairy tales.
Well, I give it about 6 months and there'll be an indie band called Turnip Princess.
Let's hope so.
Maria, thanks so much.
Great to talk with you.
Maria Tatar teaches folklore and literature at Harvard. She's the translator of The Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales by Franz Xaver von Schoenvatt. Head over to our website to listen to readings from three of these stories, The Wolves, The Toad Bride, and The Howling of the Wind.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.